Hi, and welcome to another week of Understory, WA's only environmental radio show. I'm your host, Tom Wilson. Today I talk with nature photographers Stanley and Kaiser Breeden, authors of the new book Wildflower Country from Fremantle Press, as well as Don McFarlane about the drying of the climate in southwest Australia. I'm not going to ramble too much on today to begin with. Let's get straight into the interviews. Here I am at the Fremantle Press Publishing House in Fremantle with Stanley Breeden, the author and photographer of a new book they've just published called Wildflower Country. It's a gorgeous folio-sized book of colour photographs of the flowers of southwest Australia. And, congratulations, Stanley.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah.
I understand that you're not actually from southwest Australia. I think that the accent gave it away pretty quickly.
Well, I was born in Holland, but I've been in Australia since 1952. Yeah, I'm not that old. I'll go back further than that. And we live on the Atherton Tableland, Kaiser and I, and we work from there. We live in the rainforest and do a lot of photography there as well, and writing. Mm.
And sorry, I should have said co-author with Kaiser.
Kaiser.
The book, as I was saying, is a book by outsiders. You guys aren't from here. Sometimes I suppose it takes an outsider to see what's really there. And I know when I had a look through the book last night at the official launch, there were a lot of flowers I'd never seen. It seems strange to me that, in a way, us locals don't know the shapes and patterns of our own home. What do you think some of the reasons for this are?
I think it's familiarity, really. And, you know, if you see something every day, every season of your life, you sort of take it for granted. And only when you really stop and look closely at things, then these patterns that you spoke about, they emerge. And because we specialise in close-up photography, and we came with a fresh eye, you know. We hadn't grown up with this, so it's all wonder and amazing, wow. And we travelled for 4 months to take the photographs, and we had our two young daughters with us, and all of us, you know, oh, there's more, wow, wildflowers everywhere. So, as I say, it was really a fresh eye, really, that separates us two.
And the photos have been done with new techniques in digital photography that haven't been used that much, particularly for this kind of large book of flowers of Western Australia. What's new?
Well, if you go back to film photography and emulsion photography, there are two things you couldn't do. One was to get a really good depth of field in close-ups especially, and the other one is to get pictures with both the highlights and the shadows have detail in them. Now, in digital photography, you can do it. It's a complicated and time-consuming and at times hair-raising thing to do, but you take a series of pictures and you're looking for depth of field, and the first one has the front bit of your subject in focus, and you go gradually, take more and more pictures till the back of the flower is in focus, and then you can combine those pictures. Same with the tonal range, you know, to get shadow detail and highlight details. You take a number of pictures, some just for the highlights and some just for the shadows, and the middle picture is sort of the average of all of them, and then you can bring the detail from the shadows in as well as from the highlights, which gives an amazing effect, yes.
And, yeah, it is amazing. I suppose it means that you can see the whole flower in a way that a shallow depth of field wouldn't allow. And the book also contains a whole bunch of essays about the flora, about the plants of southwest Australia. You went and learned about all the evolutionary history of these plants after you'd taken the photos. Did this increase your appreciation of the photos?
Well, I was aware of a lot of it before we went. You know, I've been in natural history, writing and photography for about 50 years, I think. And so I was aware of the Australia-wide phenomenon and how things came to be where they are and why. And the one thing that occupied our minds before we left was, why in this corner of the world is this immense variety? Because I was talking to this botanist about that just a few days ago, and there is no other place in the world that has such a diversity of wildflowers. At, at first there was some doubt because this part of South Africa may have some more and more varied, or that part of the Himalayas might, but it's pretty official now that this really is the greatest wildflower show on earth. So we are aware of that, and so our research consisted of saying why this is so, and what went before, and what are the factors that influenced all that.
And just very briefly, what are some of the factors that influenced that?
Strangely enough, one of them is poor soil. The soils in the southwest are very ancient. You know, it's a part of the world that's been exposed to, has not had influence of any kind. It's been exposed to the elements for millions of years, longer than most places on Earth, which means the soils gets leached, not much nutrients left inside, rocks weather slowly. And then at 40, 50 million years ago, there were actually rainforests here. And for millions of years, the rain leached more nutrients out. And the one that became most depleted was phosphorus. So plants had to adapt to become to deal with a low phosphorus level in the soils. And this actually happened when there was rainforest. So the first banksias, which are now a dry country, flowers were actually grew in rainforest, and fossil ones to show that, and already show the adaptations to poor soil. And then later on it became that this part of the world became drier and cooler than it had before, and it became isolated from the rest of the world, really, by dry country from eastern Australia and by the oceans from other parts of the world. That's it in a nutshell.
Okay, well, thank you from Understory for talking with us. Next, it was over to Kaiser Breeden, the co-author of Wildflower Country. Can you tell me about the journey? Any places in particular stayed in your mind that you're more attached to than others?
It'd have to be right at the end of the journey, I think, in Fitzgerald National Park, a place called Waitchinakup. That was a really, really special landscape. I think it was maybe the wildest landscape I've ever been in. And it was so dramatic, and had been shaped by recent wildfires that had been set off by lightning storms and things. And we were photographing in little gullies that had been protected from the wildfires, and trying to get the wildflowers in there. And it was just so amazing. It was really raw and wild and windy, and a beautiful landscape. Really hard to photograph because of the wind and the sand and all that. But there were royal hakeas there. That was when I first saw them, and they're like flaming pillars. They're amazing. The structure of them, they're like huge cabbages stacked on top of each other, and they can get as tall as, I think they can get as big as 3 metres. And they have this incredible gradation of colour, from rich red and green up to yellows and oranges, like autumn leaves, except they don't drop their leaves. They actually conserve their resources and withdraw nutrients, and that's how you get these fabulous colours. And it's a response to the really boring soil. And because people have tried planting them on, you know, really nice fertile soil, like they tell you to do in Gardening Australia, and they don't get the wonderful colour. They just end up like a big green stack, and people go, oh, how come? Why is this? And it's a response to the soil, like all the variety here is. It's a response to a mosaic of incredibly boring soil, and it produces outrageous stuff. You know, that's not what they tell you on Gardening Australia. It seems to fly in the face of everything we're supposed to know about, you know, getting the best out of your plants. You've got something very, very special here.
And it's quite ironic, I suppose, in the sense that it's not deficient soil for these plants. It's perfectly right soil.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I did actually notice a picture at the end, a photograph at the end of the book of a hooded hakea. Is that also from that same area? That's an incredible flower with tumbling pink stamens coming out from above the leaves.
It looks like pink noodles in lettuce leaf cups, doesn't it? A stack of them.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Stan knows all the technical names, the botanical names for things, and I don't. and I go by what they look like to me. So I've always got these analogies, you know, something looks like fluffy bunny rabbit ears, and I say to Stan, where do we photograph that? The one that looks like fluffy bunny rabbit ears, or the one that looks like iced Vovos, or what about the one that looks like pink noodles in lettuce cups? And he knows what it is, and he knows what I'm talking about. But yes, I have not remembered many of the botanical names at all. I'm just completely blown away by the shapes and the colours and the textures, and the rest is a blur.
Okay, well, thanks for talking with Understory. Yeah, well, it's been the second driest winter on record in Perth. This is a bit of a worry. It looks like climate change is beginning to bite, or has already begun to bite. Who better to discuss this with than Don McFarlane from the CSIRO?
I'm Don McFarlane. Yep. I'm with CSIRO. I'm a research manager at CSIRO in the Water for a Healthy Country flagship.
And what's the recent research that you've taken part in?
We did an estimate of what the impact of climate change might have on the water yield of surface water and groundwater resources in the southwest. That's an area between Geraldton and Albany.
Okay, now just if you can quickly summarise for us what's going on. We're drying out. When did the drying begin?
Well, most of the change in climate can be attributed to 1975. From 1975 onwards, we've had reduced rainfall, as against the backdrop also of gradually increasing temperatures. But there are also some evidence in some areas where 1965 might have been at the start of that change of rainfall. And certainly it's now having quite a profound effect on the hydrology, because a small change in climate can actually be, exacerbated or shows up as an accelerated impact on hydrology.
Okay, now most people will think about this as a decline in rainfall, less rain falling out of the sky, but it's also about groundwater, isn't it? How do the two interrelate?
Well, it's those very wet years that we used to get, particularly before 75, where we got most of the runoff and also most of the recharge. Now, in the last 35 years, we've just almost got an absence of those very wet years. So we've not had a topping up of the systems, and therefore pretty well the groundwater levels, particularly where they're under perennial vegetation, have been falling for up to 35 years.
And this is the big difference, isn't it? The areas that have bush on and the areas that have been cleared for wheat and agriculture in general, there's a difference in the groundwater.
Yes, and we've known this in Western Australia for a long time now, that if you clear an area then and you put it under dryland agriculture, you get water leaking through the system. And particularly in the wheat belt, when you get that happening, you end up getting salts being brought to the surface. What's happening now since about 2000 is that there are some areas where the rainfall has dropped to the extent where even under dryland agriculture, the groundwater levels are starting to fall. So we've actually got areas, particularly in the northern part of the southwest, where actually groundwater levels are falling under a dryland agricultural system, which is very unusual.
So the salinity problem is less of a problem?
It's actually still increasing in some areas, but the thing is that a lower groundwater level in some of those areas doesn't necessarily mean that the salt problem has been solved. The salts are built up in the top few metres of the soil, and even if the groundwater levels fall, the salts will generally stay in that area, so the area will remain salt affected.
Okay, so it's not a solution.
Well, it's actually slowed the rate of salinisation. Certainly, there's two things here, is that how much rainfall we're getting, but also the time it is since clearing. So we would expect areas that have been cleared for over 100 years or more, to the effect of the clearing, if you like, to be reducing over time. So the areas where we're still getting groundwater level rises are also areas where the rainfall hasn't dropped off as much, particularly on the south coast, and also areas where the clearing might have happened more recently than 100 years ago.
Okay, now finally, let's just talk about two areas, the Darling Range, the catchments for the dams, and then secondly, the Nangarra Mountain, where we get a lot of our water from in Perth. So starting with the hills, what's been going on up there?
Well, in about 1975, we've had this reduction in rainfall and about over 55% reduction in runoff into the dams.
And can you just explain the difference between rainfall and runoff?
Our rainfall is the amount of rain, obviously, that falls that we get, that you can measure in a rain gauge, and runoff is the amount of stream flow that you get that runs into a dam that you can capture and use. So before 75, we were using, a lot of Perth was being supplied by surface water in the dams in the hills in the Darling Ranges. Since about 1980, we've flipped over now and we're using a lot of groundwater because we've actually had a lot of groundwater in storage under Perth. There's a multiple aquifer system under Perth. So groundwater has become increasingly important as a supply of water for Perth, and I think it's running at about 60% or 65% of Perth's water now comes from groundwater.
But the Nangara Mound is running out of water, or we're sucking it down faster than it's being recharged. Is that right?
Yes, the groundwater, the superficial aquifer, which is what which forms this groundwater mound, has actually been falling, and in the last perhaps 6 or 7 years, it's been falling by about 45 gigalitres or 45 billion litres a year in storage. What's happened in that time is that the Water Corporation has increasingly shifted its pumping from that shallow aquifer down to more confined aquifer systems, and so it's actually taken water that is recharged many, many, in some cases, centuries ago. Some of the water in the furthest part of the Yarragadee is too old to be dated with carbon-14, so it's older than 32,000 years.
And we're drinking that water?
We're drinking it, particularly if you're in the northern suburbs. Northern suburbs tend to get more groundwater than they do surface water, and the southern suburbs tend to get a bit of groundwater from the Jandakot Mound. Increasingly, they're getting desalinated water from the Kwinana seawater desalination plant, and also they're getting the runoff into the Hills dams, if there is runoff, of course.
And now, if we could just cut over to the Hills, what when you say if there is runoff into the Hills dams, what do you mean by that?
Well, what's been some work that's been done through with Alcoa and with CSIRO, and some data that's been published recently is showing that not only did the runoff change quite abruptly in about 75, but also in since about 2000, there's been another reduction in runoff in a number of the catchments in the northern part of the Jarrah Forest. And the thinking is there that the groundwater that's underneath those catchments has now lost contact with the streams. So before about 2000, you used to be able to get groundwater going into the streams and flowing into the dams. And also, if the areas were wet around the streams, then when the rain did come in the winter, those areas would generate a lot of runoff. Increasingly, as the groundwater levels fall, we're not getting either groundwater going into the streams, and the areas around the streams are no longer wet, so we're actually not getting much runoff like we have.
So the ground's wet, so the water just... the ground isn't wet, so the water just soaks into it rather than going to the stream.
That's right, and we can separate at least three different sort of runoff mechanisms, and there's only about one of those three mechanisms that's operating once the groundwater levels has fallen so far. So even if we get an average year, and a few years ago we did get an average year as rainfall, we didn't get anything like an average year's runoff because the soils are so dry.
So, yeah, there's been a 25% drop in rainfall since the mid-70s in the Perth Hills, but much more for runoff into the dams.
Yeah, it varies, but it's generally thought to be somewhere between 10 and 15% reduction in rainfall and about a 55% reduction in runoff. So one of the rules of thumb, and it's not a robust number, but for every 1% reduction in rainfall, you get about a 3% reduction in runoff, so it's amplified by that amount.
Okay, so that's a huge difference then. You were mentioning in your talk that only two or three decades ago, most of the water that you drank when you lived in Perth came from the dams and the hills. Today it's from places like mainly the Nangara Mound, an aquifer north of Perth, and even that's running out. Has all this research made you a bit pessimistic?
I think the thing is that it would be if we weren't aware of what was happening and we'd actually responded. In fact, when you look around Australia, you'll find that the Water Corporation responded very early to climate change. They, from 1996 onwards particularly, brought on a whole lot of new water sources, including the we'll have soon two desalination plants. And they diversified their water sources a lot at the same time as they introduced, from 2001, daytime sprinkler bans. You can only water your lawn either two or three times a week. And there was a subsidy scheme for water efficiency appliances as well. So there's been a fairly quick and significant response, I guess, to this drying situation. But I think we're only just keeping up in many ways.
It seems pretty radical when there's, 1.3 million people in Perth, and they're predicting the next two or three decades that will double.
Yes, and Sue Murphy, who's the Chief Executive Officer for the Water Corporation, was commenting on this year's runoff into the dams. It's very, very small at this stage. 2006 was also like that, so it now looks as if we are getting some years where our runoff into our dams is very, very small, so we can't really rely on them as much as we used to.
So in the coming year, we might not drink any water out of the Perth dams?
Well, fortunately, the last year's runoff was reasonable, and therefore there's some storage over there from last year's winter. But from this, if you're looking at runoff from this year's winter, how much of that we can use, unless we get a lot more rain between now and summer, there won't be an awful lot of that to be used. It'll be mainly groundwater, particularly these confined aquifer groundwater systems, and desalinated water.
Okay, well, thanks very much for talking to Understory.
No worries.
And that just about wraps up the show for this week. But before I go, if you're thinking of going out in Perth tonight, then head for the Cezanne Karaoke Bar. That's at 566 Hay Street in Perth. Here there's going to be a fundraiser for Esperanza Verde, a conservation project in the Amazon basin of Peru. Esperanza Verde owns 58 hectares of rainforest, as well as a wildlife rehabilitation centre. And the students of Murdoch University are organising a fundraiser tonight that will have you swing from the trees a night of jungle beats and raffle treats. $10 entry goes towards the work of Esperanza Verde. And don't forget, you can podcast Understory by going to rtrfm.com.au. See you next week.